Hi, and welcome to the Dr. Robin Show, where each and every week we bring you the top 10 medical stories of the week. I'm here joined by with my co-host, Susie Robbins, who is a social worker, and we talk about all kinds of medical issues. You can reach us and email us, and we'll read questions on the air at our website at headachedrugs.com. That's just one long word, headachedrugs.com. This week we have a very interesting show, and we'll touch it up with an interesting article from last week that depression was more damaging than some other chronic illnesses. And we've always known this, dealing with depressed patients, but the researchers in the study concluded that depression is more damaging to everyday health than chronic diseases such as angina, arthritis, asthma, diabetes, etc., etc., although a lot of people with diabetes happen to be depressed. And if people are ill with other conditions, depression makes them worse, the researchers found. The researchers said that our main findings show that depression impairs the health state to a substantially greater degree than other diseases. The most disabling combination was diabetes and depression together. The findings indicate that we need to provide better treatment for depression because it has such a huge impact on people. And what tends to happen is a health provider doesn't look past the medical problems and ask about depression. What we're saying, the researcher said, is that people will also be depressed, but if you don't manage the depression, you can't improve a person's health. And in the pain field, in dealing with people with chronic pain, we know that if we don't treat depression, the pain doesn't get better. If we don't treat the pain, often the depression doesn't get better. They have to be really dealt with together. But if anybody's been depressed, if you've been depressed, you know how debilitating it is. And just in financial terms, I looked recently at some statistics that migraines and headaches cost the country maybe $20 billion a year in lost work time, and maybe a small part of that is doctor's visits and ER visits. Low back pain costs the country $25 or $30 billion. Workers' comp, lost work time, etc. But depression really overshadows everything. I think it's more than the combined number two and number three, about $70 billion. And it's hard to even to quantify that because that's lost work time totally. But a lot of people who are depressed muddle through work. They go to work and they don't seem to function very well. So lost productivity, lost quality of life, injured families, it's all due to depression. Susie?
You know, all that's interesting. One thing that you mentioned that I've never really thought of, and maybe some of the listeners haven't either, is that when you take the two subjects of depression and pain, that how closely they really are interlinked, that if you don't treat the depression, the pain isn't going to get a lot better, and vice versa. If you don't treat the pain successfully, the depression isn't going to get better. And just thinking about so many people out there who probably know someone who is dealing with both of those issues, and that how intermeshed they really are.
Well, it's interesting. Pain and depression is a whole subject, and it's an interesting subject if you don't have pain and depression. People constantly, I see many headache patients, and they say, well, you would be depressed too. Of course I'm depressed because I have headaches. But it's not necessarily true. There's a lot of people with chronic pain, chronic headaches, low back pain, who aren't depressed. What happens is people get disappointed in their life. They can't do as much. They have to cancel social engagements, lose out on job opportunities, lose their job. Their parenting time isn't very good. And so they're disappointed. Their self-esteem may go down, but they aren't necessarily depressed. And if we look at suicide rates in people with pain, they always say that chronic pain will cause suicide, and people think about it. But almost everybody who has thoughts of suicide or complete suicide with chronic pain is depressed. The chronic pain people who are not depressed actually don't commit suicide, or it's extremely rare. Suze?
You know, opening up a whole new Pandora's box here, but what about the link between substance abuse or any kind of addiction with depression? It seems like there would certainly be a link there as well, that if you can't treat the depression successfully, it's going to be awfully hard to treat the addiction.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's a lot of this is genetically predetermined. There are a lot of people with chronic pain who never would overuse their pain medicine, but if there's a strong family history of addiction, if they have anxiety and depression and they're treating their moods with the pain medicines, they're much more likely to become addicted. So addiction, depression, and pain can be interlinked, and they're all very interesting and complicated subjects. Now, the other issue, we've touched on this on the show before briefly. Susie, how would you somebody go about if they're feeling down or depressed, their motivation's down? There's a lot of symptoms of depression, sleeping problems, differences in eating, either no appetite or way too much, irritability, anger, but feeling depressed, feeling down, no joy of life or looking forward to going to movies or doing anything. How would somebody go about getting their depression treated?
Well, first of all, I think that's good that you explained some of the characteristics, because I think maybe out there some people would think that depression means they can't get out of bed, they don't want to eat, they've just pretty much given up. But there's all sorts of depressions, and some people may experience it just as feeling crummy, but still going to work, taking care of the kids, taking care of all the responsibilities that they have throughout the day. But as you suggest, not having the joy in doing most of those things. So I think for anybody that's feeling down, feeling low, or knowing somebody that is, I think the first step most likely would be is to go to your primary care physician and talk to them.
Yeah, that's a great point. Patients sometimes say to me, Dr. Robbins, I'm not depressed. I know what depression is. Depression is when you can't get out of bed. And I get up and I function. I'm not depressed. But there is a whole spectrum of depression, and it's not just one day. You know, adolescents are always depressed for one day, or a lot of people, or a few hours. It has to go on week after week, really, for us to say it's a clinical depression. Now, in the next study, we've talked on the show before, it's been a bad year for herbs and for vitamins. A lot of them have bit the dust, where it shows like vitamin E is probably has more negatives for most people. Even multivitamins. We did a piece on a few weeks ago where men on multivitamins got much more severe prostate cancer, and maybe men and maybe women shouldn't take multivitamins. But now here's a positive study about menopause and a natural extract from pine bark. And the brand name is Pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L, Pycnogenol. Now, there's been a lot of talk about this particular extract from pine bark. Pine bark's been used for various things as far as conditions, but we don't care what people claim. There's a lot of claims out there, 99% of the claims for drugs and for natural things turn out not to be true. We need large studies, long studies, placebo-controlled studies, well done. But this was a small study on pine bark for menopause symptoms, looking at fatigue, headache, vaginal dryness, menstrual problems. And interestingly enough, it suggests that the pine bark extract, pycnogenol, acts as an anti-inflammatory and may improve blood flow, and it may help the symptoms of menopause. The findings are very encouraging, according to the researchers, especially given that many women suffering from menopausal symptoms want an alternative to hormones, which may be linked to heart risks. Now, one of the problems with the natural substances, we don't have long-term studies on many of them looking at side effects. Some of them turn out to have more long-term side effects than drugs. But pycnogenol is interesting. The early reports on it look like we should do more studies, not just for menopause, but probably for other conditions as well. Susie?
Well, you know, that's encouraging to hear about that, but, you know, of course, if I'm thinking from my own experience, about a year or so ago, I tried an herb called black cohosh. Is that cohosh?
Yeah, C-O-H-O-S-H.
And my understanding is that a lot of people in Europe, especially Germany, were taking it and that it was helping with menopausal symptoms. Well, it didn't help me. I may not have given it long enough chance. I took it for about a month. But it's just interesting that I believe at this point now that is no longer being touted as something to take, and now we've come across this new one, which just tells me that, you know, it's kind of a work in progress in terms of herbs with menopause.
Absolutely. The main study that I'm aware of on black cohosh with menopausal symptoms, one of the primarily well-done studies showed it didn't do very much, maybe very mild effect. And we've had that this year for a lot of the herbs. Feverfew, we've used for years, for decades, for centuries, for headaches. But it has a very mild effect, if any, over placebo. The best one for headaches is Petadolex, P-E-T-A-D-O-L-E-X, which in the studies has really held up as well as any drug. But most of the studies do not hold up, and most of the natural treatments and vitamins not only have not been helpful, but sometimes they're more harmful and create more problems. And it turns out that we just can't believe anybody's claims unless they back it up with a lot of data. And there are stories called anecdotes. Say my grandma does well with an herb, and I say my grandma did well with an herb. That's an anecdote. That's a one-person story. Well, the plural of anecdotes, say you go to a naturopathic doctor and they say that they've treated 80 people. That's 80 anecdotes with this herb, and it helps that. It doesn't mean very much. The plural of anecdotes is not data. Plural of anecdotes is just more anecdotes. Now, if you get thousands of anecdotes and a lot of doctors or people, maybe you can then base it to do a study. But a lot of times we've had thousands of anecdotes and positive reactions to a drug. They put the drug or the procedure through rigorous studies, and it turns out to be no better than placebo. So we really have to wait. I think I'll get off of my soapbox now and segue on to our next study. There was an interesting study on family meals having a lasting impact positively on kids' diets. Teenagers who sit down to meals with their families may have healthier diets as adults. The findings, say researchers, point up the importance of the traditional family dinner, something that has fallen by the wayside in an age of hectic schedules and takeout food. Past studies have suggested that when parents and children regularly connect over dinner, children are less likely to take up habits like smoking and drinking. Based on the findings, families, according to the researchers, should be encouraged to share meals as often as possible. If the current findings are any indication, regularly sitting down to such meals could have lasting effects on teenagers' diets, according to the researchers. But I think there's other positive things. Socially, it's a good time to talk without the TV and connect. You know, you ask some families, you ask a lot of families, when's the last time you really sat down during the week or even on weekends for a family dinner? And maybe once in the last 6 months, or sometimes never. We all tend to be electronically isolated. The kids are in their room, they got cell phones and TVs and sometimes computers and iPods, and they're talking to their friends, and they're, of course, they want to talk to their friends more than they want to talk to us as parents. But it isolates people, and you know, the parents are grabbing some fast food and too busy. And if we all slow down, that family meal, that old traditional family meal, is, I think, much more important than it seems. Susie?
Well, I agree with everything you say. And I do wonder, you know, it is true that many times the kids would rather talk to their friends. But even if they can't verbalize it to us, I do think that the kids that do have that opportunity to be able to eat dinner with their parents, and the parents have made this nice dinner, maybe the kids have helped with the dinner, that somewhere in them they feel grateful for it and are happy that they're able to do it, even if they can't articulate it back. I know it's good for them long term, but I even think in the moment it has to give them some good feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's more important. There's been other studies. This study was on their diet later on as a high teenager and early adult, and I really think that it does. But there's been other studies on the health of people and families as a unit having family dinners, and it connects them. I remember when I was growing up, this was 50s, early 60s, mid-60s, we wouldn't have very many family dinners. A lot was in front of the TV, even though we only had three channels. We're we were isolated in front of the TV. But the ones that we did have, I remember very fondly, and it gives me really great memories. It wasn't a Norman Rockwell type scene with a turkey and everything, but really, I think it is important, and maybe if we get back to that, we'd all be better off. Now, there was a very interesting study recently on hand sanitizers and claims that they make. This particular product was made by Procter & Gamble, although there's many similar ones. It's not just Procter & Gamble and this product, but they had made some unsupported claims that the sanitizers could prevent colds among school children and fight germs for up to 3 hours, and the FDA made them retract that or not make those statements. But there's been many similar products. The FDA really frowns upon claims like this unless you can absolutely prove them. But how about hand washing in kids and all of these products, all of these soaps and the gels that they use? You know, we've rushed into it because it's a commercial success. The companies are making them, and all of a sudden they're promoting them on TV, radio, and print ads. Like, if you don't have these hand sanitizers and gels, you're in big trouble, or you're a bad parent, or you're going to get sick. And I see some kids come in with parents as young as age 6 months where the parents are wiping this junk on their hands in, I think, a misguided effort to protect their kids. Everything is now, we've got to protect our kids from everything later on. And in many ways, it's backfiring. And in the germ fight, kids need to be exposed to certain germs. It's been shown that if they're not exposed, they have more incidence of allergies and asthma later on, for instance, if we keep them isolated as kids, away from other kids, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't know the long-term effects of these gels. How much is being absorbed into the hand? What is it? You know, a lot of them are have different compounds in them that we're not sure about long-term. We're talking about a 6 month, 1 year, 2 year old skin, plus the psychological effects. You know, you have 4, 5, 6, 7 year olds now bringing these goofy gels and sanitizers to preschool, to kindergarten, to first grade, and they're being afraid. Instead of playing in the dirt, et cetera, they're just they're being afraid to play anywhere, and I just don't think it's going anywhere that we want to go. Susie?
I agree with you, and I'm wondering, you know, they even are now making hand sanitizers that are marketed right straight towards kids, like raspberry bubblegum flavored and grape flavored, so that, you know, the smell of it is appealing to children, where they have their own little sanitizers that they can carry around with them. But I'm wondering, what exactly are these? It's not like a bar of Ivory soap that they're washing their hands with. Is it really just straight alcohol that they're rubbing on their hands?
You know, leave it to Madison Avenue and the marketing people. They create an illness or a disease state. Okay, germs in kids, bad, bad, bad. And they go after the parents. You know, you'll be bad parents if you don't give your kid bubblegum hand sanitizer to rub, you know, every 5 minutes on their hands. I don't have a product here. You know, it's interesting. We'll go buy some products and we'll look, and on future shows, we'll talk more about what's in these. I'm not sure. I know alcohol is an ingredient in some sanitizers, but it just doesn't seem, you know, you have kids who come in from, you'll have a scene like this, 4-year-olds at preschool playing in the playground. Their hands are black, of course, because they're preschool kids and they play in the dirt. And they come in, and the teachers sometimes at these schools, because they don't have access always to sink and soap and water, and it's messy, the kid comes in and they get a squirt of this gel stuff, and they're rubbing it on their hands, no water. Their hands are still black from dirt. It's just ridiculous. What are we doing? We have to think about this before we expose our whole nation to these products. We really need studies. Suze?
You know, throughout this whole conversation, I've been thinking about a story, which I'm sure you're also thinking about the same story, because we took this child who's a neighbor of ours to a movie. It was a little boy, and right before the movie started, now, at that point, we didn't have any popcorn or any food with us because we had gone out to lunch, We were just settling into our seats to watch the movie, and this little guy pulls out his own little person hand sanitizer. And I said to him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, there's a lot of germs in a movie theater," and he started squirting it on his hand. And he asked me if I wanted some, so I said, "Sure." So he gave me a squirt, and the two of us sat there wiping our hands together. And I got the feeling that he might have been instructed from mom or dad at home to make sure he sanitized his hands before the movie started. I don't know. I was sort of surprised by it all.
Now, we have two take-home lessons from that. You got a 7-year-old little boy at a movie theater taking out a goofy bubblegum hand sanitizer and doing it before the popcorn. You see, you have the psychological effects. What's it doing to his brain for when he's 15 and 25 and 35 and 45, you know, putting in that germs are bad and the world is a dangerous place? We don't want these kids to be afraid of everything and think of everything dangerous. But also, a line that I know I've overused on this show, but it really is appropriate, the law of unintended consequences. You know, okay, we get rid of germs and somebody might not get sick from a huge amount of staff that they might ingest in, from a bacteria, but we have these germs, we're wiping them off our kids' hands constantly or their face or whatever, and dollars to donuts, we're going to have unintended consequences. They'll be getting sick with more things later on because of the lack of natural germs. Or these hand sanitizers, which didn't exist 10 years ago, which they just made up. So we don't have long-term studies on these in kids. Nobody does. And the companies cannot possibly claim safety data because they haven't been around. These haven't been around for 50 years. So sure enough, what happens in 10, 20 years when studies show that kids who use these a lot get more cancer rates or more immune system rates or something? You know, we'll all wring our hands. What did we do there? You know, what do we do? Well, maybe we should regulate these products. Now, segueing on to our next study, anxiety may persist after a miscarriage, researchers have found. After a miscarriage, depression appears to decline during the following year. You'd think that people would be more depressed, but it turns out anxiety is more of a problem. But many women and their partners continue to feel anxiety more than a year later. In people who experience miscarriage, anxiety rather than depression is more likely to be the clinical burden, according to the researchers. After 13 months studying the people, the researchers identified depression in only 2% of the women and the men after a miscarriage. We expected depression scores to be high in women initially, but were surprised to see them fall very quickly. The main psychological burden was anxiety. Within the first month after a miscarriage, over 24% of the women and over 5% of the men showed anxiety. So, after a miscarriage, people may need to be treated for persistent anxiety when therapy and medicines are available. Hopefully they're available as far as treatments. Now, people always say, just like with depression, what is anxiety? The most common is GAD, or generalized anxiety disorder. And it's usually an inner feeling of, say, a caffeine-type buzz in your whole body. You're just wound up, you're wired, or worrying, excessive worrying, constant worrying, going to sleep and your mind's going, worrying, over-worrying. And it can be both. People can feel very wound up and wired, and they can be excessive worriers. Now, other symptoms, other categories of anxiety are obsessive-compulsive disorder, panic disorder, and the like. But the most common is just generalized anxiety. And, of course, everybody's a little anxious here and there. Some people are very laid back and hardly anxious, but almost everybody's anxious here and there. But when it really interferes with functioning, when it decreases somebody's quality of life, we call it an anxiety disorder. And there's a spectrum. Some people are severely anxious, some people very mildly anxious, and it has a very genetic background. You can see in kids who are 6 years old with social anxiety or social phobia or separation anxiety, where they just won't go to school, they're hanging on to their mom's leg. Now, most kids, the first day of kindergarten, hang on to mom's leg and don't want to go. But they go, And after the tears, they're okay. But the kids with separation anxiety that's moderate or severe, they just won't go. And they cry for weeks. And sometimes it's very difficult. And they have differences in their brain. On scans, they have bigger amygdalas. The amygdala, that's A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, is part of your system in the brain that governs emotions. And you can actually see it's bigger in people with anxiety. There's other differences on scans. The Italians did a study not too long ago on women with anxiety, and they could tell who has anxiety by looking at the scan of the brain and how the brain used sugar and glucose. People with anxiety, their brains are really different, and it very much runs in families. You can trace anxiety usually in 2, 3, 4 generations. So it's a very physical, genetic problem and illness. So I think that genetics play a role after a miscarriage, of course. Many women and men recover very well after a miscarriage, go through the usual stages, anger, a little depression, anxiety, and then are fine, and some don't. Some really need counseling and to consider medicines such as the SSRIs, like Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, etc., afterwards. Susie?
Well, I think all of us out there know some people who have anxiety that where it could possibly be considered a disorder. You know, I'm also wondering from an addictions perspective, how much of anxiety fuels an individual wanting to medicate it on their own with, you know, alcohol versus drugs. I'm sure that, you know, that it's commonplace. And so when, you know, drug counselors or people working with those people who have an addiction need to really get to the root of why is somebody doing this? Is it somehow calming them, making them temporarily feel better? You know, what's going on with the person?
Absolutely. You know, I think one problem with addiction centers, sometimes they overlook the underlying psychiatric problem. People don't just become addicted for no reason. They're usually medicating some underlying mood problem, depression, anxiety, bipolar, et cetera, et cetera. They may have 2 or 3 psychological diagnoses. And unless you get them in therapy, get them on the right medicines, they often lapse back into their addiction. But they do calm down their brain with a lot of the addicting pills. Prescription medicine overuse and addiction is a huge problem in this country. The opioids like OxyContin, Vicodin, and also benzodiazepines like Xanax or Valium are big sources of addiction, and people are really over-medicating often because of depression, but often because of anxiety. It just calms them down, and unless we get at that, we don't get anywhere. But I don't blame people who have anxiety, depression. It's just so crummy to feel crummy. There was a really good book a while ago called I'm Sick and Tired of Feeling Sick and Tired. And people, even if they are very strong psychologically, it's tough fighting bad brain chemistry and fighting it on your own and just feeling terrible 24/7 for day after day, week after week, month and year after year. So a lot of people do need therapy, antidepressants, et cetera, et cetera. Suze?
I know you've talked about this term called kindling before. Maybe you want to talk more about it. But I can't help but think that with anxiety, if you start out early in life and you've got some anxiety issues that go untreated, year after year, that constant anxiety keeps building up that it has to get worse just because it has not been treated.
Well, kindling, it's like kindling logs on a fire. They get more and more, more logs, you get more kindling wood and you get a bigger fire. That's been shown with seizures and epilepsy. So more seizures, if somebody has 2 seizures in their life and they're 15 years old, they're less likely than if somebody has 100 seizures. You get more seizures sometimes. Depression, more depression gets more depression. And that's been shown in some very well done studies. If you treat depression aggressively, treat it so that people are not depressed, in 1 in 3 in 5 years, they're a lot less likely to be to be depressant, particularly bipolar depression, which is underdiagnosed. And many people are misdiagnosed as just regular depression or anxiety. With bipolar, I think kindling comes into effect. We're not sure about anxiety, but probably. I think that a lifetime of anxiety or untreated anxiety, it's just worse. Although we get more serotonin in our brain as we get older, and people do mellow out and get a little less anxious sometimes as they get into their 50s and 60s in some ways. But in general, we want to treat these things. But not everybody needs medicine, of course. Some people just need an exercise program, yoga, etc., ways to deal with it, just some therapy. But some way of addressing anxiety is crucial. Now, segueing to our next story, there was an interesting article on single parenthood and kids. People brought up by one parent are slightly more likely than their peers with intact families to have problems in young adulthood, but this appears to be due to related factors such as being poor rather than single parenthood itself. A number of ill effects among young adults were associated with greater exposure to single parenthood. But when the researchers looked at statistical techniques to look for factors that account for anything, it really appears that having a single parent, people were more likely to end up with less money or being poor, and also some anxiety. But the researchers point out that most people brought up by single parents don't have mental health or other problems, and that many people who do develop such problems as young adults were raised by single parents. It's a very interesting study because I think that if there's not too much stress in the home, if the parent is reasonably good, I think that we can very well have very good kids raised by single parents. The researchers say that their findings suggest that governments would be better off focusing on improving family function rather than just counting the number of parents in the home. Of course, nobody would ever say that we want single parents as opposed to two parents, but it's interesting when you look at the research on single parents, the kids are not coming out all that badly, except they are more likely to be poor, which is a risk factor for anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. Susie?
Oh, I think that's really good news, knowing that there's so many single-parent families out there that it's not the risk factor that maybe a lot of us thought that it was. I think it reminds me of how important it is for all of us as a community to remember those friends of ours or people we know who are single parents and, you know, maybe, you know, keep them in mind when you're having dinner and, you know, invite them over for dinner and, you know, giving a little bit extra of ourselves to those families where there is only one parent in the home. Because I think, and I can speak of this from a personal standpoint, everybody can use a helping hand once in a while. And I don't mean financially as much as just in the spirit of friendship, and really can help not only the parent but also the kids when they know they've got friends around them.
Very well said. I agree. You know, when people split up and get divorced, it seems as if family and friends often divorce one of the two. They, you know, some people have said it's the where'd everybody go syndrome. They get divorced and they turn around and where'd everybody go? And what the consequence is that is that people also abandon the kids. If they're not going to talk, they refuse to talk to the mom who has primary custody of the kids, and they're a friend or an uncle or somebody, and they've taken sides. Well, they often don't talk or have any interaction with the kids too, and that has a bad effect. At least it's reassuring to get some studies that show that the kids where there is a single parent are really not doing all that badly, essentially the same as basically as the kids who were raised by two parents. Again, nobody would ever suggest that we want to go to single parent country or that it's ideal, but it just happens that way. So we might as well look at the consequences. Now, the next study focuses on CPR, which is what people do when somebody collapses out of the hospital and they push on their chest and blow some breaths into their mouth, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And I think this comes under the heading of our accepted mantras that everybody has written in stone often turn out not to be right. In this study, they looked at rhythmic abdominal compressions, which is pushing in the front of the stomach below the chest. I'm not sure that I know how to do it, but it's very interesting reading about it, rather than standard chest compressions. And they found that rhythmic abdominal compressions, which are probably easier to do, are probably better than the way that we're doing CPR. And they forget about doing the breaths. CPR using rhythmic abdominal compressions only does not require chest compression, and it does not require mouth-to-mouth breathing, which eliminates risk of rib fractures that sometimes we see with chest compressions, and also the transfer of infections with mouth-to-mouth. Now, previous research has shown that CPR in the field can help, but it has to be very early. The success rates of reviving somebody are just 5 or 10%, and with every minute, it goes down. So after 10 minutes, your chance of success is very nil. So after 10 minutes, the researchers here say that the resuscitation rate is totally ineffective. But any medical procedure that has that low a success rate would be and maybe should be abandoned. So we have to look at other things. Rhythmic abdominal compressions works by forcing blood from the blood vessels around the abdominal organs, which is an area known to contain a large amount of our blood volume, and the blood's then redirected to circulation around the heart. The researchers found that with the same amount of effort as chest compressions, 60% more blood was pumped to the heart using rhythmic abdominal compressions. There were no evidence for damage to abdominal organs. So I'm sure that people have to be certified. We were certified in our office a few years ago. You take a short course. They now have DVD and online courses, which we're going to sign up for. But it's interesting. Maybe we ought to rethink how we're doing CPR in the field. It would be easier to just teach people rhythmic abdominal compressions because, as you may know, CPR involves a certain number of chest compressions and then breaths, and it gets complicated, and people are always weirded out. Well, it's different in an infant and in a child, and maybe if we just teach a simpler way with abdominal compressions, it would be better. Now, in another study, our Western diet, which is not great, was linked with poor colon cancer outcome. Patients treated for advanced colon cancer who followed a typical Western diet, which is high in meat and fat and refined grains, have an increased risk of recurrence and death, which is not good. The analysis focused on two major patterns, the Western diet and then a more prudent pattern, which included lots of fruits and vegetables, fish, and poultry. Patients who adhered to the mostly Western diet were over 3 times more likely to have a recurrence of cancer or die from any cause compared to those that were eating a more prudent diet. This is the first study, to our knowledge, the researchers say, in a potentially cured population of colon cancer survivors to address the effect of diet. Now, previous studies have been iffy on the effect of diet on colon cancer. We thought that increasing roughage and fiber may decrease colon cancer, but a relatively recent study showed that it didn't have very much effect on colon cancer, so that was confusing. But this study looks at people who already have colon cancer. If they change their diet to a healthier diet, they have much better outcomes. Now, the antioxidant effects of fruits and vegetables, nobody can argue against fruits and vegetables. I think that it's somewhat unrealistic when they say, and who is they, the nutritional experts, and you see even on the food channels on TV when they're talking about eight grains of servings of grains a day for a person and six servings of vegetables and fruits. Because of cost and effort and this and that, and also our stomach, a lot of people's stomachs can't tolerate a lot of fruits and vegetables. Most people get much less than the recommendation. So maybe we have to modify the recommendation somewhat. But the general idea is more fruits and vegetables, good, more high saturated fat, bad. Now, there is the Mediterranean diet, and olive oil has turned out to be pretty good, except it has calories, but it's really not bad for you. It may be good for us. Certain types of cheeses, it's not all that all fats are bad, and we don't want to absolutely have everybody on a no-fat or low-fat crazed diet, but it comes down to calories. It looks as if our risk factor really is how much abdominal fat we have. Obesity, but abdominal obesity is a key. And whatever we put into our systems, it comes down to calories in and calories out. I talk with young people quite a bit about their diet, and I think it's a slow evolution into a healthier diet into the late teens and early 20s. You know, it doesn't really work to hit them over the head and say, you have to start eating low fat and watch everything. It really takes them a while to get on a healthy kick. And many don't. I think that if you look in our country, in the United States, we know more about nutrition, the average person, than in the 1960s and 70s, etc. But we're way behind. There are whole pockets of the country, whole populations of people who really are just eating fast food and high fat and just not worrying or thinking about it at all. Susie?
You know, I agree with what you're saying, but I think we have to look, too, at socioeconomic levels and why some people are just eating a lot of fast food. I know here in the Chicago area, there was an article in the Chicago Tribune a few months ago saying that, you know, a lot of very poor neighborhoods in Chicago, one of the reasons that people are eating so much fast food is because that's the only kind of restaurants in the area that they don't even have decent grocery stores to go to. When they can get a whole meal at Burger King for $5.50, they're going to do it so that they can feed themselves.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the follow-up to that is, how can we get in our inner cities, in poorer neighborhoods, access to healthier food and better food that's not, doesn't cost an arm and a leg? Because if it costs too much, nobody will eat it. And it's not that available. There's whole areas where people have to take a bus or two to get to a grocery store that's going to serve them, that where they can even buy something that's healthy. So we need access. If people don't have access, then everybody's going to just eat what's right around, which is usually high-fat fast food. The cost is a huge issue, too. Even if people have grocery stores, they're going to go for cheapo mac and cheese, generic, etc., as opposed to fruits and vegetables, which might be higher cost. So I think cost is a big barrier to eating healthy in our country also. Susie?
You know, something you said a few minutes ago, I'm wondering if you could clarify. You said that a study had come up that surprisingly had said that the amount of fruits and vegetables one eats doesn't necessarily mean they can ward off colon cancer?
Well, there was a reasonably large study not too long ago that showed that increasing fiber, high fiber diets, do not decrease colon cancer. That was depressing because a lot of people with colon cancer in the family had gotten on high fiber diets, and it makes sense to eat whole wheat rather than refined sugars and flours. Whole wheat, we really should try to switch as much as you can to whole wheat and whole grains, not just wheat, but whole grain rice and wheat. But it didn't seem to matter as far as colon cancer, which was a depressing finding because we thought, well, maybe we could change in people with higher risk people's diets and they wouldn't get colon cancer. Now, it may be that it's not just fiber, that if we do change away from saturated fats towards fruits and vegetables and fiber, that it decreases the risk initially for colon cancer. But it didn't seem to hold up in that study. Susie?
You know, in my understanding, that in preventing colon cancer, the number one way to do it is to have routine colonoscopies. I know because I do have colon cancer in my family, so I had my first colonoscopy at 40. And it's easy. It's easy the day of the colonoscopy because you're put into kind of a la-la land. You feel nothing. The day before is tough because you have to drink this drink that cleans out your system. But it is really worthwhile when you hear that there are no tumors, there's nothing there. And I know for someone in my family, a sibling had a routine colonoscopy a few years ago, and there were some precancerous tumors found, and they were cut out. So I think it's a good time to remind everybody that routine colonoscopies are the way to go. I believe that it's after the age of 50 for people without a family history.
Yeah, and certainly much earlier than 50 if you have a family history of colon cancer. Yeah, the day before colonoscopy is pretty rough, drinking that stuff. Now they have pills, which I would prefer. It's much better than drinking the horrible stuff. And it's amazing that after all these years, they haven't come up with better ways for prepping somebody for an exam like a colonoscopy. But the day of, that la-la land that they put you in is not a bad feeling. The biggest problem with colonoscopy is the biggest problem with our healthcare system is getting these paid for. They've gone from inexpensive and reasonable and moderate to expensive, but that's a whole other subject. As an aside, it's funny, we're just talking about colonoscopies in the locker room. I play in two hockey games, one with older fellas and one or two ladies, and one with young ones. And in the older locker room, we talk about our colonoscopies and other procedures. And in the young one, they talk about dating girls and drinking beer. So it's a little different. Now, our last study here is looking at bipolar in kids and adolescents. And it turns out that the number of young Americans diagnosed with bipolar, which is basically depression, but depression plus. The number of young Americans diagnosed with it has been rising dramatically in the last few years. There's a couple reasons for this. One is that maybe we just didn't recognize it before, which was certainly true. There's a spectrum of bipolar, mild, moderate, severe, and sometimes it's overlooked. Maybe we're over-diagnosing it now, but I don't think there's any evidence for that. I think we're still probably under-diagnosing it. Bipolar is different in kids and adolescents. It often comes across as they may have some depression. Usually they do, but they may not. They may just be chronically angry, irritable, often sleep problems, decreased need for sleep at times, or they do fine and are revved up and have a lot of energy even on 3 or 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And I think there is kindling with bipolar where if we don't treat it or we treat it with antidepressants, which is not a great way to treat it usually, we may kindle the brain into worsening depression. We need to use what we call mood stabilizer, so it's a little different. And at the mild end of the bipolar spectrum, it tends to be underdiagnosed. People just have these personalities, angry, irritable, sometimes too much energy. Their mind goes fairly fast. Sometimes they talk a lot. Sometimes they spend a lot of money. And it tends to be treated more as anxiety or ADHD or as regular depression. And some people do well going on ADHD, which are attention deficit medicines such as the stimulants. But many people with bipolar get much worse. One thing that put a chilling effect on treating any kind of depression or diagnosing it was the misguided FDA's black box warning on antidepressants in 2004, like Prozac, with warning that they cause suicide. It turned out not to be true. It turns out that depression causes suicide, and it's not really the medicines. And they may retract that black box warning. They may not. But it led to an enormous increase in suicide 2005, 2006. So What we don't need really is the government cutting down on the diagnosis of depression and making it difficult for doctors, because it's hard enough to diagnose depression and bipolar in children and adolescents. Well, we're out of time. We bring you the cutting-edge medical stories of the week each and every week. You can email us at headachedrugs.com. Just go to headachedrugs.com, Dr. Larry Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S, and our email is there. We'll answer emails on the air. See you next week.